Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
A world-class commonwealth like Massachusetts should not have a terrible transit system that's just falling apart at the seams. The system is a mess today. It's an embarrassment.
For 40 years, we've been talking about funding fatigue. Where is the money going to come from to get things on track?
I just kind of looked around the room and said, oh my God, I am sitting in the Oval Office having a conversation with the President, the Vice President of this America. The American dream is still very much alive and well.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortslave, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
Well, good afternoon. It's the Friday version of our program, Bloomberg Bay State Business. Tom Maroney, Kim Kerrigan in today for Joe Shortslave and Mastu on the news desk. We're also going to hear from Janet Wu later. And as we come on the air today, the indictment that we were expecting for the former President Donald Trump has been released unsealed, and there are some very interesting details there. He's been indicted over his refusal to return classified documents found at his Florida home. This is the first time a former president has faced these kind of charges. There are seven charges, including willful retention of national defense information, corruptly concealing documents, and the list goes on. We will talk to our national political director for Bloomberg TV and radio, Jody Schneider, at 3:15. And we'll have much more on this throughout our program. It is the story, the breaking story of the afternoon. Kim and I have both read the indictment, and we'll certainly have some questions for Jody as we continue here. Also today, Janet Wu has been at the Mass High Tech Council's annual meeting where the governor spoke. The theme today was how do we keep ourselves competitive here in the state? So those are the two big ones from me. Kim.
All right. Coming up in our 4 o'clock hour, who doesn't love a good burger on the grill during the summer months, right? Unfortunately, that cookout's going to cost you more this year. We're going to speak to the CEO of Walden Local Meat. Her name is Nancy Pack. The company is in Tewksbury, and she's going to talk to us about her company and how they're trying to keep the prices down. Then at 5 o'clock, Ruby Donuts in Air. They are ranked one of the best donut shops in the nation. Now, that's not new to them. They have been ranked such before. But this year, they're even higher on the list. So we're going to try to find out.
And this guy is a character, Kim. I think we're going
to
enjoy him.
I'm anxious to speak with him. I know that you've already had the opportunity
to talk to him. He's from Cambodia, and he makes some of the best donuts around. I mean,
I just want to find out how, in a world of chain donut operations, he's been able to stay you know, relevant, and so much so that he moves up on the list. So, Anne, what are you thinking about today?
Well, a little update on air quality since we've all been monitoring. I've been, I don't know, sort of newly obsessed with the site airnow.gov, where you can enter your zip code, city or state, and find out how the air quality is exactly where you are. Right now in Boston, it's good, and it is in most of the suburbs of Massachusetts, but not for all of New England yet. It looks like one more day of unhealthy air quality in Rhode Island. Connecticut is in good shape, but conditions are still slowly improving. This is, again, wildfire smoke from Canada slowly starting to drift offshore. So it is leading to improved breathing and visibility. There have been some cancellations still, though, in New York. Forecasters say thin smoke may return on Sunday. However, it's not expected to be as severe as it has been this week. And I've been reading interviews with the fire folks up in Canada saying as long as a house, they're sort of taking the Alaskan approach, which is as long as a house is not in danger, they're going to let it burn.
Well, that's terrific. That's because the wind's blowing this direction. So I guess they can just let it burn, right? The annual meeting of the Massachusetts High Tech Council featured a lot of talk about taxes today, and the overall tone was pretty cautionary. Our own Janet Wu just back from that meeting in the seaport, and she's here with the takeaway. Cautionary, huh?
Yeah, Kim, many of those words of warning came from the council's outgoing chairman, Bob Reynolds. He's chair and CEO of Putnam Investments, which, of course, has been in the news because it was sold last week. Reynolds has been laying low since that news was announced, but he did appear at this meeting today as he was accepting the Ray Stata Award for Leadership, named after one of our state's tech giants, the founder of Analog Devices. Reynolds did not mention the sale of Putnam in his talk, but he did talk extemporaneously without a written speech on his biggest concerns for our business community. Here's part of that speech.
Last year was a tough year. Question one was a tough issue for the business community, because since that passed, this state has lost 57,000 people. And most of those people have incomes over $200,000. And what that does to state taxes, local taxes, contributions to charities, stores, shops, it touches everything. And that's a result of bad policy. And that's what we have. And when you look at communities that have lost population, I mentioned the last 6 months, we're number four for the last 10 years in lost population. The number one cause for people to leave is concern for the economy. And the thing that really drives home to me, when people leave because of that, they don't come back. So what happened with question one to me is either the beginning of the end or it's a big awakening for people of the Commonwealth. I'm hoping it's a big awakening for people of the Commonwealth. It's very interesting to me too. When you look at it, the number one place that people leave the state for, leave the Commonwealth, the state of Massachusetts, is New Hampshire. Okay, we all live here. I believe the weather of New Hampshire is pretty similar, maybe worse. Restaurants, social life, you name it. Massachusetts should be better, or is better. The number two place people leave here for is the state of Florida. I won't touch the weather, but they leave there for the state of Florida. Now, if you look at those two states, what do they have in common? One, they have no income tax. And two, they have no inheritance tax. You would think people would look at that and figure it out, that if you touch or if those two issues touch anyone, you're going to have an adverse effect on the society and on the economy. And that's what we're seeing playing out here. One of the challenges we're going to have in telling this story is a lot of times when you go up on the hill, they'll say, well, let's see how it plays out over time. By that time, it's too late.
Sobering words. And who were they for? Because there were a lot of CEOs in that room. A tradition reaching back to the founding of the council in 1977 is that the governor always attends this annual meeting to give a business update. Governor Healey supported question one, but has since pushed for other tax reforms. Reynolds delivered those criticisms before the governor's arrival. When she did take the podium, she acknowledged the challenges and concerns industries are facing in the state right now.
We've always been about innovating, and that's really what we need to do right now. It's critical to our economic growth. It's critical to the health and well-being of residents all across the state. It's critical for creating access to opportunity in every community, in every region of the state. It's critical to securing federal funding that we need for clean energy, medical innovation, advanced manufacturing, and more. I look at Mass Vision 250 and I see a great opportunity. All of the topics that you are addressing are topics that are priorities for our team. Blue technology, that's a good example. Just yesterday, the LG and I were out in Bedford at MITRE. You know, MITRE, of course, as we all know, is a terrific research hub that really brings together government, industry, and academic innovators to work on really tough challenges that are directly related to national security and economic prosperity. And we were there yesterday announcing a $2 million grant from our Mass Tech Collaborative, which will support their new Blue Tech Ocean project. It's important because it's going to give researchers, startups, and students access to shared data and R&D facilities where they can advance really cutting edge marine technology. These innovations we know will strengthen not only our maritime economy, but our coastal resilience, our clean energy transition, and our workforce as well. This is government, business, NGO, academe, research, and the beauty of Massachusetts is there's no state that has it together like we have it. We have our challenges, but we have to remember what exists in terms of the human, the intellectual capital, is really like no other. And I know others are looking to gain, both cities and states, but our job is really to put pedal to the metal and make sure that we are doing what we need to do to not only maintain a position, but really grow a position in these challenging times. I know that competitiveness is on everyone's mind right now, and I can assure you this is a top priority for me. Out migration, we've been looking at that figure and watching it for the last couple of years. I mean, we started to see some of this in 2019, and I have spent a lot of time talking with and listening to CEOs and others about their challenges when it comes to attracting talent, when it comes to retaining talent, hiring at every level. I know the issues created by a very complicated housing market right now. It's not complicated, it's just too damn expensive for everyone. We need to address that, which is why I set up for the first time a Secretary of Housing whose job it is to drive housing production around the state. I truly believe, as I should as your governor, that there is no better place to live in this state. I want people coming here, I want people staying here, I want people growing families here, growing old here, growing businesses here. But we know we have work to do to make that happen.
Race Data, Analog Devices founder and founder of the council, one of the founders, was at the meeting. It was at his urging that this council be made up of the highest level executives in Massachusetts, not representatives. And indeed, the council is mostly made up of CEOs and managing directors. You heard President Chris Anderson today, and the governor talked about Mass Vision 2050, which lays out the business goals and the priorities for the state. It is very detailed. There's a lot in there about remaining competitive, and we will bring you some of those details on Monday.
Breaking news story this afternoon. Special Counsel Jack Smith has released his two-year findings in this 37-count indictment, 49 pages. Trump faces seven charges, including willful retention of national defense information, corruptly concealing documents, and the list goes on. Let's bring in our political news director for Bloomberg TV and radio, Jody Schneider. Jody, Kim and I have read the indictment. I mean, I've not the first indictment I've read, and you always look for these little details that really make it come alive. And Smith has done a job of being very precise. There are two instances where he has Trump basically showing people things he shouldn't show them. Do you want to talk about that first?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The details, you read through this and the details kind of stop you in some cases. And one of the ones that I assume that you're talking about is how in July 2021 at Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, there was an audio recorded meeting with a writer, a publisher, and two members of the staff, according to the indictment, which we've all read. None of them possessed a security clearance, but the former president, according to the indictment, showed and described what is called a plan of attack against an unarmed foreign country that he said was prepared for him by the Department of Defense and a senior military official. And by including these details in the indictment, obviously they're showing us what they think could be evidence at trial of all these charges that you mentioned.
Jody, as I was reading through the indictment, it struck me that it appears some who were in his inner circle have come forward with this information. We have attorney one, we have employee, you know, one and two. So people in the former president's inner circle are coming forward.
Yeah, and one would expect that they're not, you know, to get this level of detail here, you know, they would have had, you know, people who were in a position to know about this. And, of course, this indictment's recounting evidence that the team, that Jack Smith and his team have gathered from witnesses and other sources in what's really a two-year effort to figure out what government documents went along with the former president when he left the White House and whether any of those constitute a crime.
Jody Schneider is with us, and we want to mention this, too, and I think Ann did in her newscast. Indicted also is this Walt Nauta,
right,
who is described as a personal assistant valet. He moved some of these documents around for Trump. And basically what Smith is saying here is he caught Nauta in a lie, and so maybe they're going to use him at some point to try to see what they can get from him, get out of him on Trump. I think, you know, going back to this, when Trump discloses these papers, and he seems to be boasting and bragging in a sense, Jody. Correct me if I'm wrong, but obviously he disagrees with this idea that he couldn't have these records. He cites the Presidential Records Act, and maybe you can debate that. But this sharing, it seems to me, gets us to these espionage charges, and those are much more serious, right?
That's right. Although the obstruction of justice charge is pretty serious as well. You know, it's not just that he took these documents and showed them around and all the other things we're talking about, but that after repeated attempts to get them back, he did not do so. So there was a conspiracy to obstruct justice, which I think is pretty telling. You may recall that is what they would have charged former President Nixon with if he had not left the office voluntarily of president.
So, Jody, there's a couple of things in here that I think are interesting. Well, there's a lot in it that's quite interesting. But number one, some of this is recorded. So are we sort of under the impression that Jack Smith has those recordings? That would be a question I would ask you. And also, it feels like there are frequent times when the former president is quoted, obviously by other sources, but quoted really indicting himself, saying things like, he would have liked to have declassified this, but it's too late.
Yeah, and one would assume, given all the evidence here, that there are recordings. Obviously, they have copies and pictures of the documents and how the documents were found. So, in terms of President Trump and saying these things, interestingly, he may actually try to use that to prove his innocence. His comment last night on Truth Social, we haven't heard back from him since, but his comment on Truth Social was, "I never thought it was possible that such a thing could happen to a former president of the United States. I'm an innocent man." He, in the past, has said, "I was allowed to have those documents. Yeah, I had the documents, but I was allowed to have them." Yeah. Now, who knows how much that will stand up in court, but his claim is that he didn't take anything that he shouldn't have taken, and that therefore this is all politically motivated, and Republicans so far, many Republicans are standing by him. We've heard from Speaker of the House and some others in the past 24 hours who say variations of it being another form of a witch hunt of the former president of the U.S.
And even his rivals in the presidential race, they're making statements attacking the government in this, but not specifically naming Trump. One of my more memorable parts on a quick read through is that some of these boxes with these documents he labeled as beautiful mind papers, which really kind of fits what we know about Donald Trump. But Jody, and I think this is a question that's been on my mind, and I don't hear it discussed often. Why was it so important for Trump to keep these papers? I mean, never mind the all the legal arguments we're talking about. Why did he want these? And it seems to me there wasn't much there except the idea that he could use all this to continue to wage war against the federal government, which is really his modus operandi at this point.
Yeah, I mean, this is all speculative, hard to get in the mind of the former president. But there's several legal and people who have known Trump have speculated several things. One is that he did want this, some kind of leverage, perhaps on some individuals or others whom he had dealings with in the White House. But also others have said he wanted mementos. He actually wanted somewhat souvenirs of his time in office. He was proud to be president. It was something that he clearly wanted to steal. He wanted to keep the presidency. He was unable to do so. But some say it was souvenirs of the time in office and thought he deserved to keep them. But all that is sort of beside the point at this point. He is he is charged with very, very serious federal crime. And this is the first time we've been talking about this all day, but it's a historic day. This is the first time that a former president or obviously a sitting president of the U.S. has been charged with federal crime.
Let's get back to the big story this afternoon, breaking the indictment unsealed and released by the special counsel Jack Smith. It was 49 pages, 37 counts ranging from obstruction to retaining classified information. I mean, there's some very specific damning information in all this, and Kim and I had a chance to read through it. We want to bring in one of our experts. June Grasso is the host of Bloomberg Law, and June, first of all, welcome. It's been a while since you've been on, and I appreciate your time today. Why don't we start with this? I mean, with so many questions here in such interesting reading, I thought. What stood out for you? I mean, I hate to ask a general question like that, but, you know, what jumped out at you?
Well, I think what jumped out is just the amount of evidence, and this is just evidence, like documentary evidence, texts and audio tapes and audio files that the special counsel has gathered. It doesn't like refer to the testimony of witnesses that they've been, you know, doing for months and months and months. So I mean, it's just stunning how much information they have in here and how much evidence they have that former President Donald Trump was, I mean, basically, it's a very serious matter, but it reminded me of like some kind of comedy where he's directing his aide to move the boxes around Mar-a-Lago from room to room. Yeah. They're going from the ballroom to the bathroom to the shower
to the plane
going to his golf club in Bedminster. I mean, it's just amazing, and there are pictures of all the places that these have been, and also they fall over. So you have classified, the highest classified documents, and the boxes opened and they fell over. I mean, there was so little care given to them, and that is just one part of it. And then you have former President Trump keeping those documents away from the lawyers, his own lawyers, who were trying to gather them up to send them back to the National Archives. Mm-hmm. It's really much stronger than even I thought it was going to be. And, and they have, you know, that audio tape that was referenced is just, you know, it's just the best evidence that a prosecutor could want in a case. It's the best evidence against a defendant, his own words.
Yeah, he's basically saying, look, I can't do this because I'm not the president anymore. So this idea that,
exactly,
the idea that he could declassify by thinking about it, that kind of goes out the window, right?
Well, it sort of went out the window for me a long time ago.
Well, I understand that.
For most of us. But yes, it's a stunning admission by him. And he knew that that was being recorded because it was being recorded for an author or something of Mark Meadows' book, and then he actually showed a map to a classified map to one of his members of his PAC. And it's just what's really interesting is that, this is the point where I think the investigation turned for me when I learned that a judge had decided to pierce the attorney-client privilege for Evan Corcoran, one of his lawyers, with the crime fraud exception, meaning that, you know, he's been involved, someone's involved him in a crime. That's when I thought this is serious, so serious. And we have some of the things that from Trump attorney one, which I assume is Evan Corcoran, some of the things that Trump said to him, because he also turned over notes and also an audio tape of his own notes about, you know, his voicemail notes about Trump. And he says, Trump said, I don't want anybody looking. I don't want anybody looking through my boxes. I really don't. I don't want you looking through my boxes. Mm-hmm. And then he says, well, wouldn't it be better if we just told them we don't have anything here? What if happens if we don't? If we just don't respond at all, or don't play ball
don't
with
play
them?
Ball,
don't play
yeah.
ball.
Right. I mean, it's right. stunning.
And by the way, June, he labels some of these boxes. One of the things that jumped out at me, the beautiful mind boxes. What else would you expect?
I think you know, and the thing is, he was an equal opportunity in the fact that he took classified documents from something like 8 different agencies. It wasn't so you get this idea that he knows what's in there, and at different times he wants to go through them, and he supervised their packing at the White House before he left. So that's a lot more than I imagined. And then you have this aide who's also been charged, and I wonder how long it's going to take before he tries to make a deal with the prosecutors and turn on Trump.
Right. June, we've talked a bit about what's in that indictment, but let's talk a little bit about the procedures here related to this. First off, this is going to be heard in Miami, which some would argue that was a brilliant situation because, you know, if anything, in Miami, this grand jury, if we're going to play these political games, this grand jury should have been more in favor of Donald Trump.
Right. And, you know, I think what they're looking at here, I think what the special counsel was looking at, it was a strategic decision. Do we have the grand jury in D.C. bring down this indictment and have the case in D.C. where we're going to get a better jury pool, most likely, or do we have the case in Florida? And that takes away from the Trump attorneys and from Trump the ability to drag it out a little bit longer by saying we need a change of venue, because they had been saying that the venue should be in Florida. So I think he took that away from them. He said, now, on the other hand, do you have a better jury pool in D.C. than in Florida as far as the prosecution is concerned? Probably. But also you had a grand jury here who heard this evidence and decided to hand down the indictment. And so I think that, you know, it was a calculated move, and I think it probably was the right move.
Well, all right. So there are people who dislike the former president. There are people who want to see justice, as they say, who are probably pretty satisfied with all this. But I want to get your reaction to something I've been thinking about, and I've told Kim about this. But what if this is exactly where Donald Trump wants everything to be right now? In other words, his modus operandi is to wage war against the federal government. I know that there are, you know, a certain number that are always with him, and then there are other Republicans who are likely Trump voters if. But what if we are playing right into Trump's hands? That, in other words, all along this has been staged by Trump in order for him to have a villain, to have this villain up and robust and running. Because, June, why else would a man care so much about documents? A man who we know is not a great reader or a great collector of information. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that they were his boxes. They were his documents. They belonged to him. And okay. That's part of what this whole thing is about. I think you're giving him too much credit. And another thing is that, I mean, he has so many villains already. I mean, he has villains in New York, in the Manhattan DA. He has villains in Georgia, in the Fulton County DA. So he has plenty of villains. And I don't think anyone ever wants to face a federal indictment like this. I mean, I just
this
don't
is
think
serious.
It is. And I think, you know, it's true there are some of his followers and members of Congress who are going to say this is all, you know, it's all being drummed up against him. But let them read this indictment and see the evidence that they have. And as I said, this is not evidence from the testimony of this person or the testimony of that person. This is evidence from texts, from pictures, from all different, you know, and from written, you know, audio tapes. They also have surveillance tapes of the moving around of those documents. I mean, I think if anyone reads this, I think it'd be hard. There'd be hard-pressed to say, oh, the FBI trumped this up. You know, the Justice Department trumped this up. Well, I mean, they're his boxes, Tom.
Okay.
Right. Maybe it's his boxes.
They're his. The beautiful
they're
mind.
My boxes.
According to the Wall Street Journal, ranchers are shrinking cattle herds because of the drought and the high costs, cutting down the nation's supply of beef. Where is the beef is literally what we're all going to be saying here pretty quick. That threat is pushing the prices of steaks and burgers to record highs. Earlier today, Tom and I spoke with Nancy Pack. She is the CEO of Walden Local Me. That's located in Tewksbury. And Nancy talked about her business and how it's somewhat insulated from these rising meat costs.
Our business is very different in the sense that because we work with farmer partners on a long-standing basis, we're able to create long-term contracts and longer-term agreements so that our partner farmers are better able to plan for their expenses for the season. So because Walden Local provides a very reliable market for our products, it takes a lot of the stress and the need for reactionary pricing for our partner farmers off the table. And that's what allows our partners to weather the storm in terms of rising costs, and we're seeing it, rising cost of feed, the rising cost of fuel. We know in the country there's been major drought in some cases, and all of that together with less processing that was available in the last few years due to lack of available labor has really put pressure on the beef industry. And the way that we have that differentiation is really longstanding commitments that allow our partners to know that they have a reliable market and that they can balance out all of their expenses because we make those commitments.
Yeah, the reliability of all that. Nancy Peck is our guest. She heads up Walden Local Meat. So, Nancy, it's going to be very helpful to our audience and to us to give us some kind of comparison. If you can do per pound you versus national average, just something that shows us that people are getting a deal here and that you're sort of beating the national headwinds you just described.
You know, if you were to look at let me take retail pricing of ground beef, for example, in maybe a typical grocery store. Consumers are going to face as high as, you know, over $5 per pound, and that is not hyperlocal meat. That is meat that may come from various parts of the U.S. and maybe even international. Our meat is competitive in terms of price per pound, but it's a very different type of meat. It's grass-fed, grass-finished beef from very local New England region, as I mentioned. And so we're providing the highest quality of meat available to your door with competitive pricing. But again, because we are a whole animal purchase program, we're able to pay farmers a premium in terms of what we're able to cover in terms of their expenses. So competitive pricing, very high quality, grass-fed, grass-finished beef, and we're able to balance all of those costs. The other thing that's different is we have our own employees, we have a long-standing processing partner, and we also deliver to your door with our own team members. And all of that makes it a much more sustainable supply chain, much more reliable. So you can get fantastic ground beef, highest quality, competitive to retail through our program, but we're full service when it comes to your door.
What I'm hearing is that if I'm going to pay $5.50 at the store for ground beef, you're going to sell me that ground beef for $5.50 with all the other things you describe? You're right there with the supermarket or a little above?
No, we would be above, but competitive when you put all of the other costs in.
Right.
We would be paying our partner farmers quite a bit for a whole animal, though.
So if it's $5.50 at the store, what is it with you?
All in, you could be paying $7.
Would I have paid that same price a year ago, $7? Is your pricing changing as a result of ground beef going up across the nation? Or has this been the price that I would have paid at any point?
You may have paid a slight difference versus a year ago, but we've been able to balance all of our pricing throughout our entire program. We also have other proteins that we sell, so we're able to balance costs. It's not just ground beef or ribeye or tenderloin compared straight to the beef industry. We offer so many other parts of different proteins as well as other products. So you're able to balance all of that. And again, we make that work so that our members don't feel the direct impact of what we're seeing more broadly in the beef industry, per se.
So, Nancy, I'm on your website, and in fact, you have pork. Do you have bacon? Is that part of the deal?
We do. We offer pork. We have bacon, pork products. We have chicken. We've now just introduced lamb as well as seafood, again, all from the New England area, as well as other products. We have beef sauces. We have sausages. So a lot of complementary products, again, not just relying solely on beef, which allows us to really balance our program and allow us to balance pricing.
Nancy, I know that you've explained to us that you work directly with some of these farmers and they have guaranteed contracts with you, but I'm trying to understand what insulates them from the issues that farmers across the nation are facing when we start talking about drought and the expense of keeping these cattle. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal that they're saying a lot of these cattle farmers are getting rid of a lot of their herds because they just simply can't afford it. What's insulating your providers?
So what is insulating is, you know, again, when you have a whole animal program, instead of paying a farmer for just specific cuts and the rest of the animal they have to sell off as, let's say, very inexpensive grind, we are not doing that. We will buy whole animals. We will pay a very, very good premium versus, you know, national average. And then we're able to sell off all the different cuts of beef, for example, that others just cannot do. And again, the difference would be many companies are buying and selling specific cuts. The rest of it would be sold so cheaply per pound. When you're buying the entire animal, we're able to pay farmers a much better wage for their animal, and then we're able to sell off all the different parts, which allows us to, again, balance pricing and offer competitive products at competitive prices.
All right. Yeah. What is your most difficult challenge right now?
Our biggest opportunity at the moment, and we continue to drive this, is we know when we have customers and members join our program, our conversion rate, or the rate at which we keep people in our program because they believe in our mission, because we are so local, we're almost like, you know, a local CSA, if you will, they stay with us for a very long time. So we have great retention. Our biggest opportunity is to get more people to learn about Walden Local, to learn about our personalized delivery service, to understand that our meat is very, very different and very high quality. So if we can get more than 30,000 members, and that's going to be through our marketing and through our being in the community, that's going to be able to have us expand our impact and expand our presence in the community. So getting more members into our program is one of our biggest opportunities.
You say opportunity, I said challenge. I guess that's why you run the business, right? Nancy Pack is the CEO of Walden Local Meat. Nancy, thanks for being with us on Bloomberg Bay State Business. We call these Friday stories. They're fun. They're usually about food. And Yelp has put out its 2023 list of the top 100 U.S. donut shops. Two of our own in the Commonwealth have made it. Cane's Donuts in Boston, a perennial favorite, is number 86. But look at number 28, Ruby Donut in Ayer, an unassuming donut shop. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. It's kind of in a strip mall up there. Number 28, they moved way up. They were the only donut shop to make the list last year for Yelp. And now there's two, and they are way up there, number 28. Let's bring in the owner-operator, Bhuchan Tan. Is a man who's had this shop for 4.5 years. He's from Cambodia. His wife, Lily Paul, runs the shop too. They have, as you can imagine, a small workforce, but man, they turn out lots of donuts. Bhuchan, by the way, goes by Chan. That's what people call him, not to be confused with Jackie Chan. So Chan, how did you find out about this this donut award? I mean, it wasn't through the press.
Well, first of all, I don't know anything about the award. Only the customer, the one that told me, and I don't even pay attention for that because I don't have time and I'm not good English for look for the news in all time, you know.
You're too busy making donuts.
Yes, I'm tired. I work 7 days a week and get up 2 a.m., you know, so I don't know anything about the news. Only the news is from the customer mouth. That's what they told me.
Well, how long have you owned the business, sir?
I got own business about 4.5 years.
Okay.
And Ruby is your daughter.
Right.
Yes.
Now, was it a donut shop before you took over?
No. The city hall told me that I'm the fourth generation. You see, the donut shop about 30, 40 years ago, and then turned to Chinese restaurant. Then I turned the restaurant closed down about 2-3 years, and later on I turned the Chinese restaurant to the donut shop.
Well, what made you decide you would go into donuts?
Yeah.
Well, the donuts is my dream for a long time when I was a young man. Plus, we don't have no money, no experience, and we fight a lot. Nobody believe me in a donut because I fought with my wife a lot. I want to be a donut shop, and my wife keep arguing, but she followed me. And anyway.
Okay. Hold on a minute, Chan. This, you're getting into something interesting here. So your wife didn't want to make donuts, and you did.
You don't. She now she work in the company still because the donut you never thought is can be a margin and to survive. I have 3 kids. You know, man.
So where do you? And what? Why are your donuts? I mean, we're looking at pictures of these donuts.
They look fantastic.
They're delicious. How many? Yeah. First of all, how many varieties? And what's your secret? Why do you have apparently very good donuts?
The secret is the point is you have to get up early in the morning and make fresh. And second is you have to make pay attention to all your flour and water and temperature and make sure you don't miss one step. If you miss one step, you're going to screw up. And plus, I've been searching a lot of restaurants. I learn shop to shop, and then I pick up the recipe. One, maybe some restaurant, I get one recipe. Some of them, I get none. So no good, I'm not going to take it. So I have to jump to the next restaurant, whatever good, then I pick one. So then when I combine together, I twist it, you know.
Sure.
So what do you mean you twist it? You're losing me here.
Yeah. What? If you don't quit it, the people open 30 years, they can't climb up to top 100, you know?
Right. He puts a twist on it, his
own.
Puts his own flair on it.
Appreciate that.
Talk to us about, you know, what it was like during the pandemic. Did anybody, were you guys obviously closed down for a portion of that time? How did you keep your customers?
Yeah, the pandemic is usually, as a matter of fact, I survived the pandemic because some customer, they keep posting, and some of them from Leominster, the one second year, they turn around the table, and the guy, they close his furniture down, and he's shopping around, he see the donut, and he tried, he like it, and he put on the Facebook, and he know a lot of customer from Leominster. That's why I survived on the second year.
Yeah. Wow.
So let's talk a little bit about your competition. How do you find the Dunkin' Donuts donuts? Are they pretty good?
The Dunkin' Donut can too far away to beat me. They get only review 2-3 star. I get 5 star straight. So the customer told me the Dunkin'.
What have you tried a Dunkin' Donuts donut?
Yeah, I tried Dunkin' Donut. Before we open, we sit down with my wife in a Dunkin'. I see the customer, they never buy donut, not even 1 dozen. They don't know what how much for 1 dozen.
So they're coming in for the coffee, and you right away you get a sense of what their donuts were like. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the coffee is hard to beat Dunkin', but I'm okay with the coffee. But the donut, I'm way up Dunkin'.
How many different flavors? You were telling me earlier, the raspberry fritter is popular, and the apple fritter. Those sound very good.
Fritter, apple fritter, any customers stuff in my first shop, I always give them sample raspberry fritter, apple fritter, cinnamon crunch over glaze, apple cider. The four of them that get hit. Big one.
How many varieties?
A lot of varieties. They have a blueberry, chocolate, a cake, apple cider, old fashioned usually, and glaze, sprinkles, strawberry.
And Chan, you make stuffed donuts, don't you? So you slice the glazed donuts and you put things inside of them, right?
That's what I created. The whipped cream with a raspberry on that. The customer love it. Usually I do raspberry. Usually, as a matter of fact, I steal a Bismarck from a Dutch bakery. I buy one and I slice it. I taste from the flour to the cream feel. I just say, I'm going to beat them. Usually,
You're doing something right.
There are rich teams and there are poor teams. And then there's us. Boston's taking our kidneys. Yankees taking our heart. It's an unfair game.
But every time I call the game, you call the business. And every time I call the business, you call the game.
All right. You know what that all means. It's time for our guru of the business of sports. He's Skip Perm. He directs the sports management program at Suffolk University at the business school there. And Skip, things are just rolling along here. Let's start with the PGA Live situation. I mean, there's still a lot to be said about all this. And I want to just bring one thing up. We have a sports writer here who did a piece on Lionel Messi, the preeminent soccer star on the planet right now. He turned the Saudis down. And Kim, he was going to give them, or you know this too, Skip, they were going to pay him $400 million a year.
A year.
That's more than I make here at Bloomberg. And I'm not really sure of his reasons, but he's going to go with a team in Miami. Skip, what are your, here we are a few days out from all this, and we're still wondering if the Department of Justice will do scrutiny on this monopolistic, you know, angle. Will Congress pull its nonprofit status from the PGA? What are some of your primary thoughts here on Friday?
Well, I mean, I think it would seem likely that Congress would pull the nonprofit status of the PGA. They're only one of a handful of sports organizations that still have it. The NFL and the MLB, they gave it up a while ago, and the NBA never had it. So that would seem, you know, really likely and probably low-hanging fruit for politicians to show that they care and react. You know, whether the government looks at it further and stops it, I haven't read anything about that as of yet, but so I'm not entirely sure the likelihood.
So what kind of relationship, when this actually happens, do you think they're going to have, number one, with the fans, and number two, with sponsorship?
Those are the two of the biggest questions I have, particularly on the sponsor level.
Yeah.
Did we lose Skip? Are you there, Skip? Or do we have a technical problem? I think we did.
Yeah,
we're talking about the PGA and the
LIV
Golf merger. And you brought up two good points, the relationship with the fans and with the sponsors. And
yeah.
You know, that's always a...
Well, I mean, you know, we've already got a number of people who are saying that they don't like this idea. So, Skip, go ahead and finish what you were saying.
Yeah, I don't know what the connection issue is there. You know, sponsors, look, they're going to vote with their pocketbooks,
mm-hmm.
and they write big checks. So if I wasn't comfortable getting involved with LIV because of the Saudi involvement, why would I be comfortable getting in with the PGA? So there are big questions that need to be answered there, but I don't think that's going to be vetted, you know, until the end of the year when the tournament turns over. You know, fans, it's a great question there. I mean, there are fans who, you know, the 9/11 families, there's probably a lot of fans there, and I would suspect that maybe at the U.S. Open and other events, you're going to start to see some protests mm-hmm. about this, and I don't know how big those protests were, but that's not mm-hmm. going away.
Skip, consider this scenario. What if in a couple of years, 2 years, we turn on the TV to watch the Masters, and or maybe that's not a good example. I don't think they're going to do much with that. But that golf is just going to look like it ever did, and that the Saudi involvement is going to be rather invisible to the common or to the average golf fan. How possible is that?
I think that's very possible. I don't think the Saudi private investment fund is interested in growing the game of golf. They're not.
Mm.
They're
yeah.
a partner, just like I'm a partner, or Suffolk's a partner with the Celtics. We have our own metrics that we want to grow. The Saudi PIF wants to grow, you know, soften public opinion on the kingdom. They want to leverage the echo chamber that comes along with sports. I see, you know, visit Saudi campaigns on PGA telecasts. They want to build relationships with U.S. companies that are touching golf. They want to build relationships with the media companies here. All of these media companies have streaming plays. All of those streaming plays are sucking water.
Hmm.
If I'm the Saudi PIF, am I making entrees to those organizations and saying, you know, throwing big monies at them to help bail them out? And then, you know, their influence goes even further. They're playing the long game here, and I think it's pretty smart whether you agree with it or not.
Mm. I, you know, you were on with us when we got this news and you talked a little bit about this, but I want to ask you again, what do you think was the impetus behind this for the PGA? Why did they make this call?
Yeah, it seems from all the reporting that the Saudis were just going to outspend them in the courtroom, in LIV Golf, no
yeah.
matter what it took. And I think it seems that the PGA was under some real pressure, not only to fight this in the courts, but to also pay out these big purses that they had committed to keep their players. And it appears that they just didn't have the financial resources to compete. And this really was, you know, an accommodation that they needed to make in order to ensure their survival.
Hmm. Well, and Skip, maybe I'm simplifying too much, but is it accurate to say if the PGA was gentler, if you will, on its players that were defecting, that we wouldn't be talking about this? In other words, they say to Phil Mickelson and the others, we're not going to ban you. I think they did
yeah.
use that word at some point. But, you know, go do what you want and come back and play when you can. And we certainly want Phil back at the Masters and at the other majors. I mean, was that a path?
Well, I think their rhetoric, you know, where they needed to adjust their rhetoric if they thought that a potential merger was down the road
mm-hmm.
is the idea that, well, do you have to, you know, check your conscience to cash a paycheck from the PGA? You know, they took the mm-hmm. moral high ground there, really called into question that of those players, and now they're taking the big check too. So I think that's where, you know, the calls of, you know, being, you know, mm-hmm. hypocrisy
yeah.
are really biting them. They'll make good with the players because the players are going to get paid.
Yeah.
And there's $3 billion of Saudi money that's going to help that.
Sure. Well, Skip, that you actually are leading me to one of the questions I had early on with this. So how does it work that you've got Phil who's sitting there and he's gotten paid $250 million or whatever it is to go over to LIV, and he's going to be playing aside some of these other players like Rory, for example, who said, I'm not going over
yeah.
no matter what, and now is. I mean, are they going to negotiate deals, or, you know, have you learned anything more about that?
Yeah, I don't think we have those details yet, and this is just on paper. You know, there isn't a signed agreement.
Right.
So I think that's one of those questions that a lot of the writers are writing about is how do you make the Rorys, the Tigers, those who said no, whole,
right,
if they're not whole. And I'm sure they perceive that, you know, they took a pass on the big money, others took it. But I don't even know the status of those, you know, Phil Mickelson. Was he earning out on that money or did he get paid up front?
Yeah.
So we don't really know. And, you know, the guy that's left in the background is Greg Norman. And what I've read is LIV is not even a part of this. This is the Saudis and the PGA, and the LIV might go on its own in some other way. I don't see how that works, but that's some of the stuff I've read.
Well, I know we want to get to other things, but I do have one more question on all this. I mean, if the Saudis, if I'm reading the situation correctly, they're out there looking for, want of a better word, vulnerable areas that they can exploit, places where they can get a foothold. If we looked around at other major sports, is there a foothold, is there potential there that we're going to see the Saudis pop up elsewhere?
I wouldn't call it a vulnerability, but I think there definitely is a foothold. The NBA just in December changed their bylaws to allow investment from minority investments by sovereign wealth funds.
Ooh.
So if I'm the Saudi, look at James Dolan, who's owned the Madison Square Garden, who owns the New York Knicks. They've been a joke of a franchise for just about virtually my entire life. If I'm the Saudi PIF, I'm going right to him and saying, we'll write you a big check, you're the biggest market, this would be a huge splash. And he's probably just the kind of guy who would take it. And I don't know them. Well, I actually did work for the man, or work for the company, but I don't know him personally. But that's where I would go, and that's not a vulnerability, that's there. And the NFL may change this too, so that has not made that change, but they may.
All right, stay tuned, as they say. Skip Perm, the business of sports. Skip, always a pleasure. We thank you, and I'm apologize not getting to our other topics. Coming up Monday, we take a look at Fed Day, which is Wednesday. What can we expect? And we'll have a wedding planner. The price, it's going up. Wall Street Week starts right now.